WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Bennett, is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Every few months, we invite him to talk with us about the latest developments in the Middle East. He went to a studio in Jerusalem this morning so that we could discuss the upcoming Israeli elections, the recent Al-Qaeda attacks against Israelis in Kenya, the ongoing Palestinian attacks against Israelis, and the ongoing Israeli crackdown on Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Now that most Israelis have given up on the prospect of peace in the near future, the Israeli government is trying to physically separate Israel from the West Bank by constructing a fence that will run at least 70 miles. I asked James Bennett to explain the purpose of this wall.
There's been a great deal of pressure from Israelis for a long time to build some kind of barrier along the boundary with the West Bank. The notion is that it will prevent suicide attackers, other forms of attackers, from crossing easily and carrying out the violence in Israeli cities and towns. There's already a fence around the Gaza Strip, and many Israelis for a long time have pointed out that so far in the conflict, none of the suicide bombers that have attacked in places like Jerusalem and Tel Aviv have come from Gaza. They've generally come from the West Bank.
Could you describe what this fence is going to look like, what it's being built out of, how tall it is? Is it barbed wire? Is it electric?
It depends where. It's still the precise path of the fence and its actual composition are both still being debated inside Israel. Different barriers are being used in different places. One place where fencing or a wall can already be seen is along the edge of the Palestinian town of Qalqilia. There's a large concrete barrier there. 25 or 30 feet high with watchtowers every couple hundred feet, stretching for now a couple of kilometers. But in other places, they're talking about maybe 3 feet of cement barrier topped by perhaps 20 feet of electrified fencing, electrified so that it will provide a signal, not a shock necessarily to someone trying to climb over it.
How controversial is this wall among Israelis?
The wall itself, the notion of some sort of a barrier with the West Bank, is extremely popular among Israelis, in the center and on the left in particular. The path of the wall, where it should actually be placed, is the subject that's caused the greatest controversy, because left-wing Israelis believe that the fence should be built right on the line, the 1967 line, or the Green Line as it's known, which is the boundary that existed before the 1967 war. But right-wing Israelis are very concerned about exactly that happening, that is, that the fence will become a de facto border. They're very anxious, in many cases, to hold on to the West Bank, either for security reasons or for religious reasons, believing it's their biblical birthright. So for them, the path of the fence is also very important. They want it built not on the 67 border and instead inside Palestinian territory, and some don't want it built at all.
Why is it the center and the left that is so strong in their support of the wall?
Well, it's really a sign of how attitudes have changed here after more than 2 years of conflict. People are simply despairing of any kind of solution, despairing of the notion, really, of reconciliation, which seemed so reasonable just a few years ago when the Oslo process was in full swing here. They're starting to think that maybe the best they can hope for is some kind of separation of the two peoples and perhaps a cold peace like exists now with Egypt. And perhaps they think a clear division between the two populations will give each population time to cool off, maybe come to its senses, and begin building bridges again.
So for Israelis, this fence means the promise of some security, or the hope of some security. What does this fence represent for Palestinians in the West Bank?
To them, it just looks like a land grab. They feel like the Israelis are creating this de facto boundary, and they're doing it right through their own olive orchards, rather than doing it on what they regard as Israeli land or doing it on the Green Line. So to them, it is a form of attack, really.
What does it mean for both the Israelis and the Palestinians to be constructing this fence, this division?
Well, I should say it's been a year, really more than a year, of fences and barriers here. I arrived in Jerusalem 15 months ago, and just in the time I've been here, the transformation of the landscape has been quite extraordinary to watch. Israeli checkpoints have become more fortified, more formal, outside Palestinian towns and cities. Ditches have been dug by Israeli forces around those same cities. Barbed wire fences have gone up. More and more fencing is seen around settlements in the West Bank. Although many settlers are ideologically opposed to the idea of fencing, believing that the army should be able to protect them and they should be able to move freely, despite that, more and more of the settlements have begun fencing themselves in. So we've seen many of these smaller forms of barrier fences going up, and now this one very large one stretching the length of the West Bank boundary. The point is that these fences are generally being built by Israelis, not by Palestinians. That said, the two populations are moving further and further apart. The social divide has become quite stark here. Relationships that existed before the conflict have died, either in antagonism or simply because the parties have drifted apart over time. People who were once friends don't really call each other anymore. All these sorts of smaller social changes are writ large, really, in the phenomenon of this new fence that's going up.
Once a wall like this is built, what does it take to take it down?
Well, that's the thing. When you actually go out and see the construction site for this fence, it's extremely striking. It looks like now a landing strip, sort of an endless landing strip, is being built through agricultural fields, generally through what were once olive groves or orange orchards. There's a stretch of land maybe 50 yards wide with bulldozers moving back and forth, dump trucks going back and forth, grading, filling the earth. This is particularly in the northern West Bank, where they're most active now in building this barrier. And when you actually see that and appreciate the scale of this project, it starts to seem like something monumental and lasting.
Right. And probably really expensive.
Yeah, it is quite expensive, and that's part of the problem they're having. The Israelis are already running quite a large budget deficit. They're seeking more financial assistance now from the United States.
Is this fence going to make Palestinians in the West Bank feel imprisoned? I know it's the purpose theoretically is to keep Palestinians out of Israel as opposed to keeping them prisoner within the West Bank, but will it feel like they're being kept prisoner within the West Bank?
Well, the problem is that it seems likely now, the way the situation exists now, that Israel, even once this fence is built, will continue to restrict Palestinians within the West Bank. The reason is that there are still more than 200,000 Israelis living in settlements in the West Bank, demanding protection from the army. So their homes will not be encompassed by this fence. They'll be on the other side of this boundary. And in order to protect them, the army right now seems likely to continue maintaining the kind of curfews and as well as the fences that exist around Palestinian cities like Bethlehem now and areas around Ramallah and Nablus.
One of your colleagues in the New York Times recently had a story saying that a lot of Israelis, or at least some Israelis, no longer want their husbands and sons in the military to risk their lives defending these settlements in the West Bank, these small settlements in the West Bank, and they think it's time for the people in the settlements to move back to Israel proper for the security of the country. Is this a growing sentiment, would you say?
I wouldn't say that it's a growing sentiment, but there is persistently a fairly strong majority in favor of bringing people back from the settlements as part of a comprehensive settlement of the dispute, which is a pretty big if. They want to see a solution, a genuine peace, before bringing settlers home. Now, we're seeing the current Labor Party chairman. That's the leader of the left-leaning Labor Party who's running in elections to be held next month, is calling for a unilateral withdrawal of at least some of the settlers from the West Bank and all of the settlers in Gaza, where about 7,000 settlers live among more than a million Palestinians. It will be very interesting to see how popular that idea proves. It hasn't really been tested yet.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Bennett. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. You've been covering violence against each side in the Middle East conflict. Let's start with something you recently covered, the violence in the kibbutz Metzer. This kibbutz was attacked by a Palestinian gunman. What happened in the attack?
Well, no one really knows how this man got into the kibbutz. He had real discipline, though. He managed to hold his fire until he got to the very center of the kibbutz, at which point he attacked a couple out for a stroll, killing the woman. The man escaped. He then ran to a nearby house where a single mother was living with her two boys, 5 and 4 years old. He tried to kick down the door. He wasn't able to do that, so he walked around the house and climbed through an open window, and he shot the mother and the two boys at close range, climbed out of the house again. The kibbutz secretary, that is the leader of the kibbutz, was rushing to the scene in the car. The man shot and killed him, and then he simply vanished. Trackers found his footprints outside the kibbutz fence, and then they disappeared after about 50 yards. He was presumably picked up by a car, drove off in a motorcycle.
How has this changed life on that kibbutz?
It's really frightened people. It's quite a left-wing kibbutz, founded in 1953 mostly by Argentinian immigrants. And they prided themselves on maintaining good relations with the Israeli Arab village next door, also with a Palestinian village, which is just a short walk away from this kibbutz, which is right on, just to the west, really, of the West Bank boundary. And a 5-10 minute walk from the kibbutz and you're inside the West Bank. In fact, this kibbutz had been fighting before this attack to try to move the root of the wall so that it wouldn't eat up some of the Palestinian village's land, even though that would have costed the kibbutz some of its own land. Now, people in the kibbutz generally simply want this wall built as soon as possible.
So this has really changed a lot of members of the kibbutz politically.
It's changing them, I think. There's still a real yearning there for their old beliefs and a real desire for this the kind of reconciliation, the coexistence that they envisioned. But I think there's a growing sense also that among these people that there's simply no other way now but to separate the two populations, not just because they're afraid of Palestinian violence, and they're still very careful to say that they think it's just a very small number of Palestinians that are involved in this kind of violence, but also because they're aware of the way attitudes have hardened among their fellow Israelis, who they think are simply not going to be persuaded to their point of view, to their notion that such coexistence is really possible.
The responsibility for this attack was taken by the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is the group that's affiliated with Arafat's group, Al-Fatah. But you say that this attack was actually controversial within Al-Aqsa. Why?
Well, there's been a debate for some time among Palestinians over whether they should stop making attacks across the boundary of the West Bank. Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in the 1967 war. Palestinians say they want to have a state in those occupied territories, just in the West Bank and Gaza. But by attacking across the boundary and attacking Israelis in pre-1967 Israel, particularly civilians, particularly left-wing kibbutzniks, many Palestinians fear that they're sending a signal that they're simply trying to destroy the state of Israel rather than that they're trying to end occupation. So there's a debate underway now among Palestinians over whether the conflict, their side of the conflict, should be restricted to attacks only against Israeli soldiers and settlers in the West Bank and Gaza. That way they think they would send a more clear message that their only goal is to end the occupation.
Now, you recently went to the Palestinian town of Khan Yunis in Gaza and looked at attacks against Palestinians there. Five cousins who lived in this camp were killed by Israeli military while they were trying to sneak into Israel to get work. How are they killed?
I was really astonished by the risks that these men were willing to run to try to get work. They lived, as you said, in Khan Yunis, which is a desperately poor town in the Gaza Strip now. The men I interviewed there said they simply can't find work inside Gaza. These men attempted to climb the fence that surrounds the Gaza Strip and reach the Israeli side, where they planned to melt into the Israeli Arab villages and work illegally for basically half the wages that a legal Palestinian worker might make, about $20 a day, they hope to make in construction. So what they did was they took a couple of ladders and they left after dark, and they waited a distance from the no man's land that you must cross before you reach the fence. And they attempted to time the change of Israeli patrols and make a run for it when the Israelis weren't paying attention. Instead, they were spotted crawling, the Israeli army said, toward the fence. And the Israelis opened fire with tanks. The Israeli army said later that they had had specific intelligence that there was going to be an attempted terrorist infiltration in that spot. And all five men were killed.
You say that you were surprised at the risks that these five men took in order to get work. How difficult is it to get work now for Palestinians in the West Bank?
Well, I should say, Terry, what surprised me is that other men have done this. It actually is it's rare, but it is done. That is, that people from Khan Yunis take this route periodically. One of the men who was killed in this attack had done this twice before successfully, and he'd spent up to 6 months at a time working in Israel, wiring the money home before finally coming back for a time to see his family. Then, last week, attempting to smuggle himself out again.
How difficult is it to get work in Gaza?
It's very, very hard. I mean, Gazans, the private sector in Gaza has been cut in half over the course of the conflict. The best-paying jobs remain the public sector jobs, which many families are dependent on. Some also work for the UN agency that administers refugee camps in Gaza. But by far the most lucrative jobs before the conflict began were inside Israel or inside the Israeli settlements in Gaza. Israel has been issuing far fewer work permits for Gazans, although that number has recently gone up again, and Israel is now issuing, I believe, about 14,000 work permits for people to work legally inside Israel. But absent that sort of work, there's simply nothing else available. Children in Khan Yunis, Terry, there's a new form of employment that has arisen. I first saw this about a year ago. There's a checkpoint. There's an Israeli checkpoint on the main north-south road as you enter Khan Yunis, and little boys wait by the side of the road. And if a driver approaches who doesn't have a passenger in the car, he picks up one of these boys so that the boy will ride with him past the checkpoint, which persuades the Israeli soldier that he, the driver, is not intending to blow himself up. So the driver can safely cross the checkpoint. He lets the boy out on the other side and pays him a shekel, or about 20, 22 cents.
Is the boy supposed to look like the driver's son, or is it the understanding that if there's any child at all in the car, that the driver isn't going to be blowing himself up?
Generally, if there's more than one passenger. And actually, now I know drivers who will do this, even if they already have two people in the car, simply because they want to have a full car. The notion is the more people you have in the car, the less likely you are to be on some kind of a suicide mission.
Has the Israeli military made any official statements about the shooting of the five cousins?
They said at the time that no guns were found on these five men, no weapons of any kind, that only two ladders were found. The men weren't carrying identification because they didn't want to have to produce it if they were actually stopped by an Israeli patrol. So Israel said that if, in fact, they were workers, then they regret what happened, that the men had done something incredibly dangerous, because it was understood that there was shooting along that fence to enforce that boundary to prevent infiltrations.
Now, you've also written about what you describe as near civil war in the Nusrat refugee camp, Fatah versus Hamas. What's that about?
Well, there continues to be real tension in Gaza between Yasser Arafat's Fatah faction and Hamas. a top security official of the Palestinian Authority, that's Mr. Arafat's governing entity. This official was killed assassinated by a Hamas gang. It was really more of a family dispute than necessarily a political one, but it's extremely politically charged. Fatah has demanded that Hamas turn over the man responsible for this killing, and Hamas refused, which basically created further undermined the Palestinian Authority's own authority in Gaza, and the situation is really unresolved.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview we recorded earlier today with James Bennett, the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He's joined us several times on Fresh Air to discuss the latest developments in the Middle East. He spoke to us today from a studio in Jerusalem. There were recently two Al-Qaeda attacks against Israelis in Kenya. Three suicide bombers blew themselves up outside the Paradise Hotel in Mombasa, which is a spot that a lot of Israelis vacation in. And just a few minutes earlier, two shoulder-launched missiles were aimed at an Israeli jet with 261 passengers flying over Kenya. Al-Qaeda took credit for this. Was this the first direct Al-Qaeda attack on Israel?
That we know of. There have been, Israel has said that it has arrested people, caught people with Al-Qaeda links in the past. But this is the first such attack, yes.
Now, the U.S. has been saying that it doesn't want Israel to retaliate if it's attacked by Iraq. What about this attack from Al-Qaeda? Is the U.S. pressuring Israel to not take any action? Because on the other hand, the United States wants all the help it can get in the war against terrorism.
Well, and the Israelis were already providing plenty of help before this happened, but very, very quietly. And the expectation is that that's how it will continue. Israel, officials here say, does not perceive it in its own interest to be seen as taking a very, very high-profile role in the American war on terrorism. They see that that's actually probably one of Al-Qaeda's goals, that is to draw Israel into a more high-profile role in this conflict and therefore thereby rally more Muslims, they hope, to their banner.
Do you know what the United States is promising Israel in return for Israel lying low if there's a war with Iraq?
Well, they've made certain arrangements with the Israelis, providing them access to satellite information, for example, so that they have very quick monitoring of any action in the western desert of Iraq where Scuds would be likely to originate. They've made assurances to Israel, I'm told, that they will make every effort to suppress, from the very beginning, to suppress any kind of fire from the western desert.
What's your impression of the popular opinion in Israel about the United States' pressure on Israel to not retaliate if it's attacked by Iraq?
People here are pretty sophisticated about their own predicament and the position of Israel if there is a war in Iraq. I think that there will be considerable pressure, however, on the Israeli government to respond, particularly if there are Israeli casualties. The reason is that Israelis are raised on the notion that their deterrent capability is the one thing that keeps them safe. That is, the fear of their Arab neighbors or the belief of their Arab neighbors that Israel will respond forcefully if attacked. The fear is that if they don't respond, that deterrence capability is diminished, and that is the most dangerous thing for Israel's security in the long term.
Now, Prime Minister Sharon has said that members of Al-Qaeda are in Gaza and Lebanon working with Hezbollah. Arafat denies this, and he recently said about bin Laden, "I'm telling him directly not to hide behind the Palestinian cause. He never helped us. He was working in another completely different area and against our interest." How have Arafat's remarks been interpreted in Israel and among the Palestinians?
Well, they're widely understood and sympathized with, I would say, by Palestinians who saw bin Laden's comments, even in the wake of the September 11th attack, about the conflict here as essentially opportunistic, that he was seizing on this conflict to try to bolster his own position without ever having done anything in particular for the Palestinians for a long time. Palestinians are slightly jaded when it comes to promises by other Arab leaders to do something to redress their grievances and to mitigate their circumstances. On the Israeli side, I'd say Israelis generally don't believe anything that Yasser Arafat says anymore.
Is it possible that, in fact, Arafat's group is not affiliated with Al-Qaeda, but Hezbollah is, or Islamic Jihad is? I mean, these are groups, Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, that don't recognize Israel's right to exist, whereas Arafat's group, Al-Fatah, says it does.
It's certainly possible. In that sense, they certainly have a common goal that is also shared by Hamas, which is quite explicitly to destroy the state of Israel. Beyond that, though, we haven't yet seen evidence of these sorts of links. The Israeli government recently has been talking a great deal about these links, particularly in Gaza. The Palestinians, again, view this as another form of opportunism, that is, an effort by the Israelis to ride the coattails of the American war on terror to justify their own continuing conflict here with the Palestinians.
Where is Arafat now, and what are the restrictions that Israel has on him now?
Arafat is still in Ramallah, the West Bank city where he's been effectively held now for more than a year. He got out of there for a day or two during that time. And he is still in his compound in Ramallah, which Israeli forces have reduced to now just a couple of buildings. He, as I say, though, his freedom of movement has not been tested lately, hasn't really tried to go anywhere. Generally, for several years, he would attend the Christmas Eve Mass in Bethlehem, which is a very short distance from Ramallah on the other side of Jerusalem. Last year, Israel prevented him from going, and just last weekend, the Israeli government announced again that it was not going to permit him to go to Bethlehem this year either.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. James Bennett is my guest, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Israeli elections are coming up on January 28th, and Sharon will be running against Amram Mitzna, a former general and the new head of the Labor Party. What is he standing for? What's his platform?
Amram Mitzna is the mayor of Haifa. He's also a former general. He served many, many years and fought in several of Israel's wars, was badly wounded three or four times in just one of them. So he has a record as a fighter. Haifa has a very large Israeli Arab population, and he's built a reputation there as being able to build some bridges between Haifa's Jewish and Arab communities. He's running on a pledge to take immediate action to try to end the conflict by negotiating rather than by fighting. He said he would immediately open negotiation with whatever leaders the Palestinians choose to put forward as their negotiators, that he would also unilaterally withdraw from the Gaza Strip, and over time he would begin to withdraw from the West Bank too. If he becomes convinced, he says, that negotiations are going nowhere and are effectively hopeless, then he will carry out a unilateral withdrawal from parts of the West Bank behind this new barrier that's going up, perhaps modifying the course of that barrier somewhat, and simply withdraw behind this line and say, this is our state, and you guys figure out what you want to do with this the territory that we're now evacuating.
How is public opinion dividing between Mitzna and Sharon?
It's early going now. We're just sort of entering the intense phase of the campaign here. Sharon is generally, he remains quite popular. He has successfully positioned himself now as a centrist candidate. He was attacked from the right in the Likud primaries and withstood those attacks and was reelected to represent his party in the campaign. The effect of that primary, though, was to make him again look more like a moderate in the eyes of many Israelis who are used to him after 2 years and trust him. And he is definitely the favorite going into the campaign. The Likud, though, has encountered some unexpected turbulence, which is that it's gotten into a really, what is starting to look like a very serious scandal involving the way other candidates for Likud spots in parliament were chosen. There are claims, very recently the Likud created what's known as its list, that is, its ranked list of people who would receive seats in the 120-seat parliament based on what proportion of votes the Likud gets in the election, which is held January 28th. In any case, there are allegations that people accepted bribes to vote for particular candidates in this intra-party contest. People are quite outraged about it. And it seems the Likud, that is Ariel Sharon's party, is losing a little altitude because of it.
The Second Intifada was seen by many people as having been instigated in part by Ariel Sharon's provocative actions. And I'm wondering if the majority of people in Israel seem to see Sharon as one of the causes of the violence now, or as a solution to the violence now.
Terry, it's paradoxical. Israelis generally blame Yasser Arafat for the conflict and hold him responsible for it. They feel like that Israel did nothing wrong. And they argue that Israel, in fact, had made what they consider a very generous peace offer right before the conflict began, and that Yasser Arafat's response was the Intifada. Palestinians argue that that offer was, in fact, miserly and a gesture of bad faith. Ariel Sharon ran on a promise of restoring peace and security more than 2 years ago. Arguably, Israelis now feel less secure after 2 years of his leadership than they did before he became prime minister. Yet he remains overwhelmingly popular. It seems to be partly a sign of how little confidence Israelis now have that any real partner for peace exists on the other side. It's also a sign, I think, that Israelis see little hope of any kind of quick solution to the fighting. That is, what they need is Ariel Sharon's approach, slugging it out day by day, patience, determination, what they regard as a trustworthy ex-general to lead them in this enduring conflict.
Do you think, and I know this might just be speculation, but do you think that Ariel Sharon has had a true change of heart on any issues pertaining to the possibility of peace, the possibility of a Palestinian state, the possibility of negotiating with the Palestinians?
This is a question that journalists here, political analysts, everybody asks almost daily. It's very hard to judge so far in the evidence. He has certainly made at least a rhetorical commitment to the idea of a Palestinian state, and made statements like that that suggest there is a new Ariel Sharon out there. In the past, in his autobiography, Sharon argued that there already was a Palestinian state and it's called Jordan. That is, he didn't want to cede the West Bank and Gaza and have a second Palestinian state, as he thought of it, right on Israel's borders that would threaten Israel's security. Again, whether he's really changed his thinking on that or whether he's simply managed the relationship with the United States, managed the Israeli politics quite brilliantly, is a question that I can't answer.
Are there Palestinian elections planned for January, too?
There are notional Palestinian elections in January. The likelihood of their being held is quite low now. The Palestinians themselves say they don't expect them to happen. One reason, paradoxically, is that the Americans have been resisting these elections after calling for democracy and the Palestinian Authority. They don't love the idea of elections now, particularly at the presidential level. That's the office that Yasser Arafat now holds, because they fear that these elections would only wind up strengthening Arafat. And the goal, the American goal, stated goal of President Bush now, is to see Yasser Arafat sidelined and a new Palestinian leadership step forward. It's quite an interesting moment on both sides here right now. There is a good deal of political turmoil and a certain amount of uncertainty about how elections will actually play out if real alternatives were presented. That is, if Israelis are really presented with an alternative policy negotiation, for example, which the Labour candidate is saying he would pursue, whether they would actually flock to that. It's an untested proposition. Similarly, on the Palestinian side, if someone were really able to challenge Yasser Arafat in a free and fair election, a monitored one, internationally supervised, be interesting to see what would happen.
Is there anybody on the Palestinian side who seems like, outside of Yasser Arafat, who seems like they would be a real contender to be elected if, in fact, there was an election?
Well, now I'm going to contradict myself slightly. No, the answer to that is no. There's nobody right now on the Palestinian side who has Yasser Arafat's stature. And I think, and this is one reason the Americans are so concerned, I also think that Palestinians feel so under fire, so besieged right now, that they would regard it as a concession to Israel and a concession to the United States to replace Yasser Arafat. That in a sense they're rallying around their leader, seeing him embattled by Israel, and are likely to give him their support. There's also, partly as a matter of a very careful and well-executed strategy by Yasser Arafat for many years, there really isn't any other Palestinian leader in both the West Bank and Gaza who has his kind of broad popular name recognition, let alone appeal.
There's a new document being drawn up that's being described as a roadmap to peace. It's being drawn up by the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the UN. Is there anything new about this plan? What's in this plan, as far as you know?
It's by far the most detailed plan the Bush administration has yet embraced for returning the parties here to the bargaining table. And it actually specifically envisions the creation of a Palestinian state at the end of a process of concessions by both sides, the creation of this Palestinian state in 3 years, in 2005, according to the draft version of the document, still being revised and revised. It's unpopular now with both sides here, quite a bit more unpopular with the Israelis. The Palestinians are increasingly seizing it as a lifeline, even though it requires concessions of them that they regard as excessive. And the Palestinians feel like they're being asked to do too many things before the Israelis are being asked to make significant concessions.
This document has been put on hold until after the late January Israeli elections. Why?
Well, the Palestinians say it's an effort by the Bush administration to help re-elect Ariel Sharon. The argument is, and you hear this within Israel as well, that it would put Sharon in an extremely uncomfortable position if this document were put forward now and he were expected to either give it the thumbs up or thumbs down, because it would force him to essentially endorse, accept these very specific steps, including a settlement freeze, that is a freeze on the expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, which would be extremely unpopular with the base of his support on the right, and possibly could even cost him the election. The Israelis would argue, and advisors to Sharon do argue, that it's simply not in the interest of the United States and the so-called quartet, its diplomatic allies in pursuing this roadmap, to put forward this plan right now, because they don't want to force Ariel Sharon to make this decision. They don't want to force, Sharon's advisors think it isn't in their interest to put the government of Israel in this position at such a delicate moment.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. The news in the United States, outside of the Trent Lott story, has been very, very much caught up with the possibility of war with Iraq. And I'm wondering if that possibility is getting a lot of attention in Israel, and if that's a really big concern among Israelis now.
It's getting tremendous attention, and in fact, the defense minister, Shaul Mofaz, just returned from a series of meetings in Washington with American officials, and in what I'm sure is a coincidence, the newspapers today are full, the Israeli newspapers, that is, are full of leaks saying that the Americans may attack as soon as January. This was the big news here in Israel today. There's expectations that the war is going to happen. Israelis regard it as inevitable, and they think it's going to happen quite soon.
Is that war supported by most of the public? Do you have a sense of that?
In general, yeah. The Israelis are hoping that this war will produce the new Middle East that the Oslo Accords never did quite generate. The hope is that while Israelis, I don't think, are overly concerned about Saddam Hussein and the threat he poses here, or at least haven't been until war breaks out, they are quite worried about some of their other neighbors, particularly Syria, Iran, and they regard a war in Iraq as a first step towards really ratcheting up the pressure on those countries to, if not make peace with Israel, at least cease their support for terrorist organizations and halt some of their other belligerent ways.
During the 91 Gulf War, Israelis were given gas masks to help protect them in the event of chemical or biological attacks. What kind of preparations are being made now for the possibility of such attacks?
Well, Israelis have kept those gas masks, they're required to keep them, and they've been required to go out and refresh them, make sure that they're in working order. That's been going on for some months now, quite smoothly. Israelis have gone and gotten the masks checked out, gotten their atropine prescriptions refilled, as an anti-nerve agent. Those sorts of preparations are being carried out. Israelis are required in any kind of new house now to have some sort of a safe room, that is, a room that they can retreat to in the event of an attack, be protected from chemical fumes or some sort of biological agent. So this is a country that is generally on guard against these sorts of attacks, and there's quite a good deal of awareness of what to do in the event of one.
Do you have a sense of what the general sentiment is about a war with Iraq in the West Bank and Gaza?
I would say it's generally viewed in the West Bank and Gaza as belligerence on the part of the United States, that is, bullying, I would say, picking on a guy who isn't an obvious threat, trumping him up, making him seem like a bigger threat than he actually is. And I think it's being factoring into what is really rising resentment among Palestinians about American policy in the region. I'm constantly asked, as I do interviews in the West Bank and Gaza, why does America support dictators in Saudi Arabia? Why do you support dictators in the region? You're supposed to be for democracy, but you only go after the dictators you don't like, guys like Saddam Hussein. The Americans, are demanding democracy of us, but we don't see you putting pressures on the Egyptians, for example, to truly democratize. Palestinians, like Israelis, are quite sophisticated about policy in this region. They know the governments in the region. They know how they function. And they take a very jaundiced view, I think, of claims that Americans may be making the region more safe for democracy.
Is your family preparing for the possibility of chemical or biological attacks?
Well, my wife today is down in Tel Aviv doing a day-long course in what you do in the event of a chemical or biological attack. Again, there's only so much preparation you can actually do. A lot of families will, expat, generally families, I think, will leave in the event of war. It's just a question of how much warning we're going to have.
I hope you don't mind my bringing this up, but I know you have a new baby. Are you spooked by all of this?
Well, yeah, we're all, I think everybody with children here, everybody with family and everybody, period, is a little bit spooked about the possibility that something like this could happen. In general, the betting here is that Jerusalem in particular is safe because it has such a large Muslim and Arab population. And also that, if anything, Saddam Hussein is in a far less of a position to send any scuds toward Israel in general this time around than he was 10 years ago, because the Americans are already in control of the airspace there. There's already no fly zones. And he is believed to have been able to make less preparations in the western desert that would be the launching site for those sorts of attacks. So people generally are talking themselves into, and I certainly am also talking myself into, believing that it won't be such a problem here. But it's something we think about. And for babies here, they issue you a small box. Because you can't put a gas mask on a baby, they issue a sort of a box that you're supposed to put the baby in to protect him or her in the event of an attack like this.
What does the box look like?
I don't have one yet.
Bethlehem, where Christ was born, is in the West Bank. Christmas is coming up. What does Bethlehem look like right now, and what do you think Christmas is going to look like in Bethlehem?
Well, I spent the morning today in Bethlehem, which is just outside of Jerusalem. It's under curfew again today. Very few Palestinians moving in the streets. Some Israeli armored vehicles moving in the streets. Israel moved back into Bethlehem. The Israel army took a big position again in Bethlehem in late November after a suicide bombing here in Jerusalem on a bus. The bomber came from Bethlehem, which is just outside the city limits. Bethlehem is in bad shape. This is the big tourism time of year. A couple of tourist buses have been admitted inside. I was in Manger Square, which is the area right in front of the Church of the Nativity, which Christians believe marks the spot where Jesus was born. There was one tourist bus there. There were a lot of very desperate vendors trying to sell keffiyehs, you know, the ornamental Arab headdress, to journalists who had arrived to see what was happening in Bethlehem in the advance of Christmas. The streets are quite torn up by tank treads and such. It's quite a change. 2 years ago, Bethlehem 2000 was supposed to be a major event, and a lot of money was invested in Bethlehem to prepare for a huge onslaught of tourists that simply hasn't materialized.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay.
And thanks, I wish you and your family the best. Thank you.
Thanks. All the best to you.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. He spoke to us from Jerusalem.